संस्थापकाय च धर्मस्य सर्वधर्मस्वरूपिणे अवतारवरिष्ठाय रामकृष्णाय ते नमः। जननीं शारदां देवीं रामकृष्णं जगद्गुरुं पादपद्मे तयो श्रित्वा प्रणमामि महोर्मुहु। नमः श्री यतिराजाय विवेकानन्दसूरये सच्चित्सुखस्वरूपाय स्वामिने तापहारिणे। We have a very, very distinguished visitor with us today. We are extremely happy to have with us Dr. Amrita Sam, who has a doctorate in probably in education. She has done a lot of work in the field of education. She is connected with this Vedanta movement perhaps for more than 4 decades. And she is very closely associated with many of our centers, many of our swamis. She is so very well known. In fact, you know, every year she comes to Belur Math and she spends quite a long time in India, a keen and deep student of Vedanta. She has already, you know, she has written at least 2 books. I mean, one is a translation of that immortal Ramakrishna Punthi that she translated into English. And now she has written a work on her own, The Mother of Mayavati. It is about the life of Mr. and Mrs. Xavier, but it contains many other information and ultimately how Mother Xavier virtually became the mother of Mayavati. It's an extraordinary life story. Rather, without going much deep into it, I would leave it to the author to give you a true glimpse of how she could really catch the spirit of this and then bring out such a wonderful book. I was just glancing through it. I have not read it fully, but it's very beautiful. But first of all, you know, language and then the contents and so on. Really, you know, actually, sometimes we feel Swamiji has been very partial to the Westerners. Somehow I feel that he gave his best in the West. And the relationships, apart from his probably brother disciples in India, maybe with monastics it might have been different. But amongst the lay people, I wonder if you take out Kidi or Alasinga Perumal or a couple of others in India, I think he had much, much larger number of Western disciples and admirers who were very, very close to him. Somehow he seemed to have reserved his best. And that way we were quite deprived in the sense that he gave all his best in the West and it was almost, he was exhausted and he was at the fag end of his life journey when he came to India. So, you know, that way if you study, you know, even if, to my mind, even if you go through that book, Reminiscences of Swami Vivekananda, the reminiscences by Western disciples, some of which really bring tears to your eyes, written with such poignancy, such a personal touch, such rare incidents, bringing out clearly the multidimensional personality of Swamiji. So that way, you know, this Mr. and Mrs. Xavier, they played an extraordinary role in Swamiji's life. They are British actually. They met them, it seems, after one of the lectures. This Mr. Xavier asked Ms. MacLeod, does this Swami, is this really what he says is true? He is really what he is? Then she said, yes. Then he said, then we should follow him. And you know, that is the kind of implicit faith they developed. Because you know, Swamiji's work, his mission, his method of initiation, the way he could convey, it was all just not at all earthly. They were all ethereal. In many cases, he would transfuse, really inject spirituality, so to say. So, you know, it was very, that experience, that is something which can never be expressed, that can never be created, that can never be spoken of in its true dimensions. But, you know, we get glimpses here and there. That way, you know, finally after through a few meetings, once during a personal meeting, he clearly asked, Mrs. Yever, will you not come to India? I will give you the best of my realizations. So the author writes, from that day, I think her spiritual destiny was designed and that is how her life completely changed. See, even today, if you go to Mayavati, you see the condition there. What must have been some 100 years back, you know, it's something unimaginable. Even more than 100 years back, it was 1899, finally they made a formal beginning there. The search was for it. Because you know, Swamiji always wanted to create an ashrama in the Himalayas where there will be complete search after the truth, or an ashrama completely dedicated to Advaita. Although he was so dear to Sri Ramakrishna, and everywhere he says that if the image worship can create a Ramakrishna, I would say, I mean, he spoke in such language that any number of idol worshippers I'm prepared to tolerate or meet or accept or whatever it is, because he knew. So for such a person, he also had in him that tremendous, that spirit of Vedanta, that pure consciousness, the idea of Atman and Brahman. So he wanted an ashrama where there would be nothing else. So he was searching for it, and he wanted a true person who could really build it that way. So he knew that by temperament it was much easier for Westerners to take that idea, and that's why he left that job for Westerners. He knew that it was much easier for them to accept this idea of pure consciousness, true Vedanta, and work to build an ashrama. You know, here immediately within short time we transform it into a kind of a personal worship or ritual or things like that. That's what some of the Swamis also tried to do in Mayavati and got a dressing down from Swamiji. There suddenly, you know, he visited, he saw in every room there was Thakur's picture and people waving incense sticks and all that. He scolded and said, remove everything. So somebody, of course, wrote to Holy Mother, who clearly said that we are all Advaitins and what Swamiji did was true and correct. So for such an ashrama, for building such a rare treasure, even now, you see, Mayavati is our pride that occupies the highest place amongst our ashramas in one sense. It's a life's desire, life's ambition for devotees and others, even Swamis, to go and spend some time in Mayavati. So you can imagine the person who created it, who was the founder of such an ashrama, what an amount of sacrifice and struggle she must have undergone to build it up. Money, men, climate, resources, everything was a huge task. But she bore all that. And to cap it all, the maverick monks with their own idiosyncratic behavior, it was impossible to keep them together that way. Because you know, the place is so stilling, you know. Even a very small thing can erupt into a huge battle, so to say. So there will be constant quarrels, these, that. Because you know, we are not really prepared for that kind of a stilling atmosphere. It dazes you into some kind of a silence. So at any opportunity, they will explode. And finally, you know, you can imagine, even that was not, that silence was not sufficient for somebody like Virajanji. He said, no, there is too much of noise. I should go still interior. He went down into the forest, into Shyamalathar, and again Mrs. Xavier it was who really gave him the money, this and that, to set it up. So you can imagine her life, her place in the Ramakrishna movement is something beyond words. She was an exceptional lady, and that's why for Swamiji first itself in a personal meeting, he clearly addressed her as mother, as it is the practice. So, but then slowly she really evolved into a true mother of Mayavati. So let us hear that story from Dr. Amrita Sam, a very close devotee. We know each other for decades. So it's really a pleasure to have her with us. So we welcome Dr. Amrita and also request her to really tell our devotees about her book and also whatever she has to say about Mother Savior. Thank you.
No, it's not. Can you hear me, everybody? Okay. I'm going to do kind of a combination of things where I'll be reading parts of the book, a few pages at a time, and then interjecting other things so you get a little flavor of the story. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about the research or anything else afterwards. So excuse me for looking down at the book, but I haven't memorized the whole thing yet. Charlotte was seated, hunched over in her chair, musing while her niece's two dogs and a cat affectionately watched over her. As she pulled the cashmere shawl closer to her chest to warm herself from the London chill, she observed the calendar and saw the large letters 1927. Although her vision was weak, her memory, especially of the early days, was vivid. Charlotte was doing what she did so frequently, remembering those days back in 1896 when she first heard about the Vedanta philosophy, the ancient yet eternally modern Indian religion that would become her passion and her purpose. She recalled her first private interview with Swami Vivekananda, the monk who introduced her to Vedanta. He addressed her as mother and then asked her, "Would you not like to come to India? I will give you of my best realizations." She reflected on those words and realized that at that time she had no conception of the force behind them. When she heard him speak, she knew she was hearing the truth, just as Tantine had felt. Charlotte felt more than just a resonance with these teachings. A forceful revolution was taking place within her. When she thought about these principles, he had said, "This separate self must die. Then we shall find that we are in the real, and that reality is God. And he is our own true nature. He is always in us and with us. Let us live in him and stand in him. It is the only joyful state of existence. Life on the plane of the spirit is the only life, and let us all try to attain to this realization." For years, she had been looking for answers to life's perennial questions. What is the purpose of my existence? How can I know the eternal? When and how will I experience inner peace? She remembered the peace and stillness she felt living at Mayavati, the ashram she and her husband had founded in the isolated region of the Himalayas. In those early days, after her early morning meditation in her upstairs room in the ashram building, she would walk down to her bungalow, where she would spend the day quietly, looking at the snow-capped mountains. Hearing nature at every step filled her with wonder. Usually one of the servants walked down with her, because there were so many wild animals, and because they wanted to talk to her and seek her advice. Then she would spend her day tending her garden, cooking her meals, distributing medicines to the villagers and workers, editing articles and books on Vedanta. It was indeed a wonderful life. She loved inviting one of the monks for tea and making some British delicacies in her portable oven, and hearing about their concerns and struggles, and talking about Vivekananda. This is Charlotte's story, how a privileged woman of the Victorian era is transformed into the mother, a woman of fearlessness, strength, and compassion, through the practice of meditation, discrimination, and selflessness. The Saviors had lived a comfortable life in the heyday of London. They had been married for 20 years when they met Swami Vivekananda in 1896, and they were financially independent without work responsibilities or family responsibilities. They had no children. And they enjoyed the thriving metropolis that London was at the time, attended lectures. And that is how they met the Hindu monk who had been lecturing in London that changed their lives into an inner journey towards peace and unity. This monk, Swami Vivekananda, had come to London the previous year and became the talk of the town. It was during this time that they met Swami Vivekananda. Charlotte lived with her husband, James Henry, who she called Harry, as did Swamiji, in South Hampstead, a newly developed neighborhood in fashionable London. Charlotte was 49 and Henry was 51, when they first heard Vivekananda speak, as seekers of truth, the saviors were both preoccupied with religious questions and dissatisfied with the forms and theological dogmas that was considered religion. They may have been spiritualists for some time. When they were interviewed in Madras, they said that they had not attended any church for over 20 years. But they had heard about an Indian yogi from a friend of theirs, and so they sought him out when he returned to London during his second visit. One can assume that Captain Savior, who had lived in India for 5 years as a non-commissioned officer before he was married and before he came to India for the second time, was interested in India and everything about India. And Charlotte was probably a typical upper-class woman who was involved in charitable activities, social and cultural things, when she met Swamiji. She was described by one of the monks as short, active, intelligent, and kindly. In photographs that were taken before they left for India, both Charlotte and her husband are dressed formally. She has short, blonde hair that is pulled back, and he has dark hair parted in the center. Their eyes are intense and focused. And it was during this time when Swamiji had come the first time, but it was his second visit to London, where people who later came to India to help him with his mission got very involved in his work. So it was May or June of 1896 when they first heard Swamiji speak. And they attended his talks for several months, and they both felt spontaneously that this is what they were looking for. So as the Swami was mentioning, one evening after one of the lectures, Tantin, who was often around Swamiji, came up and started talking to Captain Savior and said, just started talking to him, and then he asked her, "Is he really what he seems? And in that case, one must follow him and find God." So he then approached his wife and asked her, "May I become his disciple?" And she said, "Yes." And then she turned to him and said, "May I become his disciple?" And he jokingly said, "Well, I don't know." So they obviously had a very warm and comfortable relationship with each other. One tries to imagine how the saviors felt when they were hearing Swami Vivekananda speaking in London. Of the many things he said, "The whole world is full of the Lord. Open your eyes and see him. This is what Vedanta teaches." Not only were they hearing these words, they were seeing somebody who had realized these truths. So they attended many of his classes. Nobody knows how many because there are no records of how many people attended his classes. And they did that probably, possibly even every day for several months. And then in July, when most of the people in London leave, they invited him to go to Europe. And they went along with another devotee of Swamiji's, Henrietta Mueller, who was the woman who purchased the first part of Bellarmat. So they went to Switzerland with him, and Germany and other places. During that course of that trip, Miss Mueller left, and they got to be with him alone. And while they were in Switzerland, Swamiji repeatedly talked about having an ashram in the Himalayas. Now, contrary to earlier belief, he had actually talked to them about this before they even went on this trip, that he had wanted to develop an ashram in India in the Himalayas. And when they were with him in Switzerland, they both felt spontaneously that that's what they needed to do. So they returned to London in September. They were with him for about 10 weeks. And he spent one night at their home. And he wrote a letter there to Tontine saying that he was at the Savior's home. And then in November, which meant 5 months actually after they had met Swamiji, they sold everything that they owned, their possessions, their homes. They owned multiple properties. And they lived in temporary quarters, and they were ready to leave whenever he was. So they left with Swamiji the end of November from London, and then they met Mr. Goodwin in Italy, and from there they went with Swamiji, as all of you know, to India. And they saw his grand success and how he was welcomed in India. And when they met Swamiji, they really accepted him not only as their spiritual guide, as their guru, but they thought of him as their son. They had a relationship, very much a parental relationship with him, wanting to protect him and provide for him. And that continued till the end of their lives. So it was after this time, right before they left for India, that Swamiji wrote a letter to Lala Bhadra Shah. He wrote him many letters, as many of you know. And he said at that time, "I have three English friends with me. Two of them, Mr. and Mrs. Xavier, are going to settle in Elmora. They are my disciples, you know, and they are going to build the mat for me in the Himalayas. It is for this reason I ask you to look for some suitable site. We want a whole hill with a view of the snow range, all to ourselves. It would, of course, take time to fix on a site and complete the building. In the meanwhile, will you kindly engage a small bungalow for my friends? My friends will live in this bungalow in Elmora and then go about looking for a site and a building." So in this letter, Swamiji is referring to the Saviors as both his friends and his disciples, and they were both to him. They loved and respected him. Charlotte had searched for years and had now found a philosophy that had appealed to her, her nature and her tendencies. She had found a teacher who respected her mind and heart and called her mother, and believed that she could manifest her divinity through sincere effort and regular practice. He offered her the opportunity to move to India and help spread the message of Vedanta. Her passion had been kindled, the fire had been lit, and soon she would become Mother Savior. So they left in November, and they arrived in South India, and then eventually went to Calcutta, stayed there for some time, and before Swamiji went to Darjeeling, they went ahead to Darjeeling and stayed there for some time. The Swami had a very strong conviction, and he said, "We shall not be able to rise unless the Western people come to our help." He already, at that time, had several Western disciples with him, as you know, Goodwin and the Saviors, and soon Margaret Noble, Sister Nivedita, and Sister Christine would join him, who would help his mission. His mission in India was to raise the masses and to remind everybody of their spiritual nature, which would guide their life accordingly. He wanted to develop an organization whose focus would be the service of God and man. He believed that those white faces will have more influence in India than the Hindu. Moreover, they are vigorous. The Hindus are dead. Then the Saviors traveled through North India with Swami and settled in Elmora, a British hill station, where they hosted the Swami and other monks and continued to look for a property. So most of you who have been to Elmora have seen the Thompson House, which is what they rented, and the Swamis lived there with them. And while Swamiji was with them in Elmora, he learned that the editor of Prabhudabharata had just passed away, and he suggested that Captain Savior and Swami Swarupananda take over the management of the magazine. So that happened in May, and by August they had printed the first edition of the magazine. All of the equipment was shipped there and everything. And one person wrote, "For the time, August 1898, the printing was not at all bad. They had performed almost a miracle. The two persons who between them bore the brunt of this transition was an English woman and her husband, Mrs. C.E. and Captain J.H. Savior. Never before had a good woman been led by her maternal instincts to assume an obligation that called for such ceaseless vigilance and drew upon the art and science of management quite to the degree that Mrs. Savior had been." So she was such a force and so committed and to Vedanta and to spreading Swamiji's message. So with the assistance of Swami Swarupananda, of course, they traveled around different parts of North India with Swamiji. They went to Dehradun and other places trying to find the appropriate site. But it was with Swami Swarupananda that they finally toured through the interior of Elmora and found the site that would later become Mayavati. The purchase price was 7,000 rupees. The original property was called Mayapat, the place of the Divine Mother. And there was a belief among the villagers, the Paharis, or mountain people, that a circular enclosure of stones located on the estate was a shrine to the Divine Mother. There was no image there, but they would often offer flowers or leave stones there. Swami Swarupananda renamed the ashram, the property, Mayavati, a Sanskrit word meaning abode of Maya or Mahamaya, in honor of that village tradition. Now, it consisted, the original property, it was expanded later, consisted of 25 acres of forest land at an altitude of 6,400 feet, 50 miles east of Elmora, and commanded a magnificent view of the Himalayan snow peaks. There was at least one usable building and several huts, and it had originally been a tea garden that had been owned by a Scottish man. And most of all, it met Swami Vivekananda's criteria of being an entire hill. There's a description of the property. There was the main building, a small two-storied house that had been used for tea processing. The entrance faced east towards the mountains. The ground floor, like the upper floor, was a large hall divided into enclosed rooms, as they are now. The walls that still exist today were made the traditional way with cow dung, mixed with straw and other materials. The floors were wooden throughout. At present, the original floors are covered with cement. Upstairs, there was a large hall. There were no rooms. Tea leaves were dried in one area and processed in other parts of the building. All of the areas later became rooms, and only had partial partitions that were not raised to the ceiling until 1966. The stairway leading to the upper floor was located within the area that is presently the monastery dining room. So when Swami Vivekananda went to San Francisco, shortly after the property was purchased, he spoke about Mayavati, and he said, "On the heights of the Himalayas, I have a place where I am determined nothing shall enter except pure truth. There I want to work out this idea. There are an Englishman and an Englishwoman in charge of the place. The purpose is to train seekers of truth and to bring up children without fear and without superstitions. They shall not hear about Christs and Buddhas and Vishnus and Shivas. None of these. They shall learn from the start to stand upon their own feet. They shall learn from their childhood that God is the Spirit and should be worshipped in spirit and in truth. Everyone must be looked upon as spirit. That is the ideal. The hour comes when great men shall rise and cast off their kindergartens of religion and shall be vivid and powerful in the true religion, the worship of the Spirit by the Spirit. So as a messenger and servant of Sri Ramakrishna, Swamiji desired not to bring a new philosophy, but a new method of spiritual practice into the world at large. And Charlotte and her husband, Harry, were determined that this could happen. So as Marie-Louise Burke wrote about Swamiji's gigantic mission, it was to alter at its deepest source the whole thought current of Western people. And this without in any way disturbing their inherent greatness, their long evolving capacity for rational thought, their powers of scientific analysis, their innate ability to invent and to explore, to brave any storm and hurdle any obstacle, their passion for freedom, their capacity for compassion, their yearning for truth. Swamiji knew there was only one way to save these priceless, long-developed human qualities from erosion, and that was to root them in the unshakable, adamantine truth of Advaita Vedanta, the idea, thou art that. Charlotte and Harriet had lived a very different life in London. They were used to the many conveniences of a large city, food, clothing, possessions, basic necessities, social activities. Not only were there no basic necessities and conveniences available at Mayavati, they were not surrounded by friends or family either. What kind of courage and strength did it take for them to leave their country and move to a foreign country under British rule? What made Charlotte so independent and confident? She had been raised in a well-to-do family with 10 siblings and a very dominant and domineering father and a rather submissive mother. This probably contributed to her rather independent nature and her internal strength, along with her philosophy about the divinity of the soul. How dramatically their lives changed when they moved to Mayavati. Now they lived in the midst of majestic snow-covered mountains in a secluded forest region with only bridle trails and no roads. Yet they were braced by the respect, love, and affection of a young band of hard-working, self-sacrificing, enthusiastic, and idealistic monastics. All the monks were disciples of Swami Vivekananda and, like the saviors, wanted to satisfy their guru's desire to build a place at the heights of the Himalayas where Easterners and Westerners together could strive to realize their oneness with the ultimate reality. It was also to be a center that would emanate and spread spiritual thought to humanity. One wonders, did they ever regret purchasing the property or moving to India? I don't think they ever had time to even think about it because they were striving for both their own realization as well as service to others. The vastness and heights of the mountain ranges, the depth and density of the surrounding forests, coupled with the spirited company, friendship, fellow feeling, love and respect of the monks and the blessings of their guru gave them spiritual sustenance, inner peace, silence, power, and continued inspiration. Before Swamiji went back to the West for a second visit, the Saviors requested him to send some more monks, and he sent 4 more monks to Mayavati who were all involved in building roads and constructing buildings and clearing the jungle and helping with the management of Prabhudabharta, which by that time had moved there. So in 1899, Mayavati was established. They moved there on Thakur's Puja, which was March 19th, 1899. And the Ramakrishna Mission at that time only had 2 other centers, and that was Bellarmat in Calcutta and Madras. There were no other centers whose primary and sole function was the practice of Advaita Vedanta. And until today, even though there are over 175 ashrams, there still is no other ashram that focuses in strictly on Advaita Vedanta. The ideals and the principles of Advaita Ashram were written by Swami Vivekananda in March 1899, and they became their foundation. And it sums up both Swami Vivekananda's ideas and what would become the focus of and the transformative factor of Charlotte's life. It's really quite beautiful, and it's often repeated there. In whom is the universe? Who is the universe? In whom is the soul? Who is the soul? Who is the soul of man? Knowing him, and therefore the universe, as ourself, alone extinguishes all fear, brings an end to misery, and leads to infinite freedom. Wherever there has been expansion in love or progress in well-being of individuals or numbers, it has been through the perception, realization, and practicalization of the eternal truth, the oneness of all beings. Dependence is misery. Independence is happiness. So they moved there in March 1899, and about a year and a half later, Charlotte's husband died. He refused to leave the property and go anywhere for medical treatment. So he died in October, and shortly after he died, a young American monk came. His name was Amritananda. He was a brahmachari. And he stayed there for a number of years, and Charlotte developed a very close relationship with him, as she did with many of the monks who were there. So first her husband died in 1901, in October. Then Swamiji died in July of 1902. And then 4 years later, Swami Swarupananda, who was then the president of the ashram, he passed away suddenly. And both of these Swamis, Swamiji and Swarupananda, were like sons to Charlotte. So it was her spiritual perspective that kept her from suffering so deeply from these terrible losses in such a short time. And once the initial organization of the ashram was completed, how did Charlotte actually spend her time? She lived a very intense and regulated life. As I mentioned earlier, she slept in the main building for the first couple of years before they built her a bungalow that's called Mrs. Savior's bungalow. It's no longer really used now. She would walk down to the bungalow with a servant. She would tend her garden. In the evening, she would go up to the monastery and have dinner there and attend the evening reading or talk. She often read something. From a letter written to Tantin just 2 months after they arrived in Mayavati, we learn that it was actually Charlotte's savior who started the charitable dispensary. She started distributing homeopathic medicines within 2 months of their arrival. And that, as many of you know, became the charitable dispensary and later the hospital that serves thousands of patients every year without charge. So then they also expanded quite a bit the press building Both. They built a dispensary building and they also built a press building. The press building is still there to this day and is going to go through some renovations quite soon. It was around Swami Virajananda took over Swami Swarupananda's position after Swami Swarupananda passed away in 1906. And she then again developed a very close relationship with him. They continued the work that Swami Swarupananda had been dealing with, which was collecting information to develop the complete works of Swami Vivekananda. So they published the first four volumes there, working on it together. And then Swami Virajananda thought that they should publish a life of Swami Vivekananda, which they worked on also together. And she often corrected Swami Virajananda's writings. And it was around this time in an annual report written by Swami Virajananda dated 1913, and he's giving the history of the ashram. He talks about what the activities were of Mayavati, propagation, educational work, and charitable work. And then he writes a beautiful paragraph about Charlotte Xavier that shows his admiration for her as a person, as a mother, as a Vedantist. And he wrote, "Though we are not allowed to mention the name, we cannot but conclude this short history and report without stating the fact that the life and soul of the Advaita ashram has been one who has all these years from the very beginning devoted with unflinching zeal and marvelous steadfastness and renunciation, and above all with an unbounded love and self-forgetfulness, her best energies and resources, material and spiritual, to the upkeep and furtherance of the cause of Swamiji in numerous ways as embodied in this Himalayan ashram. Let the Advaita Ashram Brotherhood keep before it her life of practical spirituality as the ideal of true discipleship and self-surrender to the cause of the Guru. May she live long among us, shedding the serene luster of her saintly life." So he had such admiration for her. There was such respect. The people in the villages called her Bhagavati. She was, by everybody's standard, really the Divine Mother to them. Even Holy Mother called her Mother Savior. She had been transformed by her selflessness and her devotion and her steadiness and her meditation and her commitment to the ideas of Vedanta. Besides the many other qualities that she had, she was a beautiful writer as well. She had a real gift for writing, and her writings are a clear reflection of both her knowledge and practice of Advaita Vedanta. The titles of her articles and the contents are original and creative. In the back of the book, there are all 25 articles that she wrote that were published in Prabuddha Bharata during the period of 1899 to 1914. And in the beginning, when she would write articles, she would not sign her name. She never signed her name, never gave her name. She either wrote an Advaitin or CES, which were her initials. The style of Charlotte's writing is even, flowing, and quite poetic. Her allegory entitled Overheard in the Garden is a delightful way of expressing the adoration of the sun by plants. She wrote, "I was awakened from my reverie by the bells of the neighboring monastery pealing forth their sonorous chimes, and it borne upon me that I had comprehended the secrets of nature and communed with the spirit of life." Clearly, this indicates her communion with nature. In one article, she asks the question and gives the answer, "Does not the universe resemble a symphony? a perfectly elaborated harmony of tones consisting of contrasting yet inwardly related movements succeeding each other as the quick, slow, and painful. Was she in touch with this unity in variety? Her Advaitic understanding is found in all she expressed in these articles. In another article she wrote, "It is our finite conception of things that associates and limits them to names and forms." Again she wrote, "Only by drawing on the higher self that the mind is strengthened." At one point when Tantin visited, there were many of Swamiji's disciples who used to come to Mayavati in addition to many of the direct disciples who were there. And Tantin, being a world traveler and very vivacious and active, one day said to her, "Don't you get bored? I mean, here she is surrounded by three mountains, you know, surrounded by mountains and forests, and there's very few people around, and it's a very isolated place. They purchase groceries twice a year, I mean, staple food. It would take 4 days to go from the closest train station by horse to get to Mayavati." So you can just imagine what it was like, or try to imagine what it was like. So Tantina asked Charlotte Xavier, "Don't you ever get bored?" And Mother Xavier's response was, "I think of him." So this gives you some idea of where her mind was always with Swamiji and Swamiji's ideas. In 1914, when Swami Virajananda had felt that he had really had worked hard enough and he had always wanted to live a life of intense tapasya, he was going to just live in some tent someplace in the hills. And Charlotte refused for him to do that, told him it was much too dangerous. So she ended up purchasing the property that's now called Vivekananda Ashram, Shamlatal. So in 1915, she went there, and she stayed there from May 1915 until March of 1916. She returned to Mayavati for 3 days and said goodbye to everybody. And then she proceeded with Swami Virajananda down to Calcutta via Varanasi. And as she had done in the past, from the very beginning, she presided over the meeting of the trustees of Advaita Ashram. Until 2002, Advaita Ashram was a completely separate organization from Belur Math, meaning they had their own trustees and their rules were somewhat different than some of the other centers. In 2002, it merged with Belur Math, but still maintains the focus on Advaita Vedanta. So she purchased that property, and there she was. You can imagine a woman, a Western woman, sitting at a meeting with Swami Brahmananda and Swami Premananda and the direct disciples, presiding over that meeting. So Charlotte was actively involved in editing the life of Swami Vivekananda and the complete works of Swamiji. She continued to work on the life even after she went to England in 1916. In addition to writing articles, she also managed the ashram. She took care of the guests, especially the Western guests who came to visit. And interestingly enough, the direct disciples were writing letters to her instead of to the president of Advaita Ashram. They had that kind of relationship with her and that kind of respect for her. Someone once asked Gurudas Maharaj, Swami Atulananda, what it was that Swami Vivekananda had taught Westerners that made them so committed to Vedanta. And he replied, "He taught them how to calm the restless mind, how to control the senses, how to lead the natural desires into spiritual channels. He taught them how to meditate, how to form the habit of thinking spiritual thoughts. He explained to his students that religion was not a question of belief, but of realization. And realization was the result of earnest practice. Charlotte really is an example, a living example of the transformative effects of spiritual practice. She purchased, developed, and managed Advaita Ashram Mayavati for 20 years, and it was through her leadership that it became a major publishing house and a place for spreading the message of Advaita Vedanta. It was also the place that trained many of the swamis that later went to the West, as well as took high administrative positions in the order. She also purchased Shamlatal, located a few hours away. And she returned to India in 1916 in April. She was living first with her sister. It was during the war, World War I. And then later she was cared for by her two nieces. And she continued to write Swami Virajananda through those years. And he wrote her until her vision became so bad. And after her death, Swami Virajananda said that he had three mothers, the mother who bore him, Holy Mother who initiated him, and Mother Savior. Swami Premananda, when he referred to her, said, "She is our mother, an example of superb renunciation, an exquisite ideal of self-sacrifice." Swami Vivekananda wrote about her, "And that Mrs. Savior, because she did not care for honors, has the worship of thousands today, and when she is dead, millions will remember her as one of the great benefactresses of poor Indians." So Joseph Campbell says that a hero is one who is in search of the self and follows a passionate quest for immortality. And to me, that's really what she was, a real inspiration to others around her, and to this day, very much an inspiration to many of us. So I'd be happy to answer any questions or talk about the research or anything else. I don't know how much time there is, Maharaj. I could just say a little bit about the research very briefly. I was in Shamlatal for my first visit. I'd been to Mayavati in 1984, and then it was 2000, whatever, I don't know what year, when I finally went to Shamlatal. And while I was there, I was typing or transcribing some of the letters that she had written to Swami Virajananda. And I was also cleaning out their dusty library when I realized, my God, there's no book on Charlotte Savior. She built Mayavati and she built, you know, Shamlatal, paid for it. How could it be there's no book on Charlotte Savior? You know, there's Antantine and obviously Nivedita and Sarah Bull and so many, Christine and so many people, but how come nothing is on her? So I called Bodhisarananda and I asked him, you know, "Would you like me to write about her?" He said, "Oh, yes, that would be great. I tried a few other people, but they were too busy." But I had no idea at the time what I was getting into because, in fact, nobody knew much about her at all. They had no idea what her maiden name was. They didn't even know the year of her birth. And so it was a real exploration. You know, trying to find out what her maiden name was, going through all the marriage certificates, you know, from the British census and all of that to learn what her maiden name was so I could figure out what her family, where they were from and who her relatives were and all of those connections. So it was wonderful. And one thing I should mention, one of the most rare things about her, in addition to what she became and how she followed that message, is she's the only woman who they had a memorial service for at Bellarmine, other than Holy Mother, who we don't really consider a woman. But, I mean, really speaking, shortly after she died, they had a memorial service for her. So the program that they had and what they wrote about her is in the back of the book as well as a lot of the records. You know. Well, one of the things, of course, that helped was going through the diaries in Mayavati, the original diaries, which are no longer available to look at because they're so fragile. They're from 1901. And with all the little bits about whether they could see the snow-capped mountains or, you know, that the doctor was late by 45 minutes because his watch wasn't working correctly and all of these little bits and about this Swami and that Swami. There were Swamis who provided materials for me. I got quite a few of her letters from Swami Pravananda at Bellarmat. From the archives, Swami Prabhudananda in San Francisco had letters that she had written to Swami Prakashananda, who used to be a worker at Mayavati and later went to San Francisco. The assistant editor at Prabhuda Bharata, Swami Madhurananda, went to Shamlatala and got some photographs for me. I don't think there was any one person that really... I think you can read most of her experiences from her writings, from her articles. She was, as none of us talk about those kinds of things because it's not acceptable to talk about, she her life showed what her experiences were really like, that she could live in a place, an isolated place with a group of Indian monks, for years and years on end, and be completely contented or appear to be complete, you know, to live without being restless or anything, indicates something about her inner life. But her writings very much indicate to me her, yeah, very much. Unfortunately, there were no relatives, known relatives, alive. Her two nieces who cared for her, the last one died in the early 70s, I think 72. It was about the time that Gargi was doing some research and had somebody working for her in England, and they were hoping that they could meet with them, but they never could because she passed away. And they had no children. So I was able to go to the town she grew up in, which was Cheltenham. Going through the census, I was able to find the building she lived in, the building her family lived in when she got married still exists. The building that Swamiji visited and stayed in their apartment still exists.
It's London, which part of London?
Southampton. And they lived in Wimbledon. They lived in different places within London, mainly London. Yes? Excuse me.
What made her go back to London?
She was aging by that time. She died at the age of 83, and she left 16 years before that. So when she arrived in India, she was already 50. And as you know, Ramakrishna thought 50 was an old person. And she was, by those standards, over 100 years ago, she was considered older. And living in India under those severe conditions really affected her health. So, and her sister wasn't well, and it was during the war. Now, there's one reference in the letter that Swami Turiyananda wrote the year after she left in 1917, saying that he had heard that she was coming back to India. There's nothing further about that. I can't figure out if that happened because some of the monks from Mayavati went to Varanasi and met with him and talked about her and how that information came, because there was nothing that happened after that that I could find that indicated she was coming back. She actually decided 3 years before she went back to India that she was going to go back. And she wrote Swami Brahmananda, and she told him, I'm going to be going back to England. And she basically set her conditions. I will continue to give my donations, but this is the condition that, you know, it's only Advaita Vedanta, and Prabhuda Bharata continues to be published. She was very clear about that. Yes? I spoke with a man whose father was in Mayavati as an employee during her time. And as most people who have read anything about that time, you know, they considered her to be a goddess. They really did. She not only, it wasn't only her behavior and her warmth and her caring about people and the animals and her love for, you know, the cows and the goats and everything around her. She also helped a lot of them financially. And she was the one who encouraged the employment of many of the villagers. So the two villages that are closest to Mayavati, Forti and Suri, both of those, it went from like 4 employees to 60 employees by the time she left, and that was 1916. So many people were employed as a result of Mayavati being there and were influenced by these teachings of Swamiji. So, I mean, she was really a wonderful combination of both the bhakti with her love for Swamiji and a jnani in her practice of Advaita. I came in contact in 1967, and both of my sisters were initiated devotees, and through that, it kind of happened, I guess. Well, you know, nobody had done it, and so it just seemed like it was waiting to be done, and I had just recently retired, and it seemed something I would be willing to do, not knowing what I was getting into, of course, but she never left that description, and as I wrote in the book, there's no indication as to when they were initiated. There's no record of that because Swamiji didn't keep those kind of records, as you know. So, but he called them his disciples, and they obviously were. And actually, at one point, during the time when Nivedita was still alive, she was in communication with Tantine, and she wrote something about that they wanted to be have initiation and she implied that it was sannyas. It never happened because, you know, Captain Savior died and then Swamiji passed away. So we don't really know what that means. But I imagine she must have had some very profound experiences being in Swamiji's company for months on end. And, you know, how could she not have that had been transmuted to her? I can't imagine how it couldn't.
Is it okay? Are we through? Yeah. If nothing else, then we shall. So we are extremely happy to have with us Dr. Amrita. She is also very close to many of us, many of her monks, because she has been coming to Ballymud for more than 4 decades now. So you see, if you see the life of Mother Savior, you know, it's very extraordinary. And as Dr. Amrita at the end said, unless she had had some life-transforming experience, it would have been impossible to do the type of work she did. See, for someone from the West brought up in such comfort and that kind of an atmosphere, see, even now Mayavati is not a very ordinary place. Conveniences are just, you know, you imagine how it must have been 100 years ago. Perhaps, you know, tigers and leopards must have been coming for evening tea regularly. So, you know, that kind of a situation. And for someone from such a place like London to stay, you know, even in the capitals of India, people would feel grossly inadequate compared to what's there back home. In such a hilly terrain, an impossible location. I mean, absolutely, I think there can be no doubt she must have an extraordinary life-transforming experience with Swamiji. Otherwise, it would have been impossible for her. I think probably, you know, that's what over the years, she knew that she was designated, she was commissioned for a great purpose for Swamiji. She lived, she executed that, she knew her time was up, it was no longer necessary for physical presence. So she went back because she had realized her life's dream. She really done what her guru really wanted her to do. It was then at that stage of life, it was immaterial for her whether she was in Mayavati or in England. Because by the time she was so imbued, so saturated with Swamiji, wherever she was sitting, she was always kind of in his presence. So, you know, that was the kind of transformation. You know, if you read, each one of those disciples were very close to Swamiji. I mean, it's mind-boggling, the type of transformation. So, you know, even many years later also, it's possible people can, you know, many such stories. You know, very recently someone came, walked into my office and spoke about someone. That person is the head of the department of some law department in some university in West Bengal. He says just he was so depressed, he was down and he was absolutely at kind of no hope, that kind of a youngster. Suddenly he read a small book of Swamiji. Whole life was changed and today that man is heading one of the universities in West Bengal. So you know, Swamiji's influence is very much there for all of us to make use of. So if it is so, even now, at this instance, for any casual reader, for someone who, what it must have been for those to live in close proximity, to be molded by him all the way. I mean, it's something which cannot be put in words. So we are extremely grateful to Amrita for coming here and sharing her, the contents of her wonderful research work with us. So it's always a pleasure to meet her and talk to her. So I heartily thank her on behalf of all of you. So, thank you, Amrita. Thank you very much. Thanks, all of you. Jai Shri Guru Maharaj ki jai. Jai Mahamai ki jai. Jai Swamiji Maharaj ki jai. So, next week, please remember, on the 6th, we have a very big function. That's release of a book. And again, a very charismatic president of the order. President of the most charismatic presidents after the direct disciples, Swami Virishwaranandji. His Bengali edition of his reminiscences is quite big. It's a big, big volume. Now the Hindi edition will be released here next week. It's at 6 p.m. Swami Smaranananji, Vice President Maharaj, will release the book. Please come in large numbers. We'll have the function in Vivekananda College, Vivekananda Hall, because we expect quite a large number of people. So please come in time and take your seat. Otherwise, you may have to stand outside. Thank you.